Ars Electronica 2009 Human Nature Podcast.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Bernhard. Very thought-provoking and challenging presentation. Certainly, I think there's going to be lots of questions when the time comes for the audience to put questions. Okay, I think we'll move directly on. Shinsuke Shimojo from Japan.
Okay, so good afternoon, everybody. First of all, I would like to thank everybody who are involved inviting me here. I enjoy jogging along the river every morning. It's a beautiful town, beautiful beer, wine, food, as well as stimulation in terms of science and art. I really enjoy. Here's my title: Implicit Aspects of Human Nature from Cognitive and Neurobiological Perspective. Oh, by the way, I have been hated by a kind of people in the past. They are simultaneous translators. The reason why I was hated is only because I speak too fast in Japanese, but also in English. So what I'm trying to do today is to be loved rather than hated by them. But I might forget in 5 minutes. Nonetheless, I will try. Okay, so I would like to talk about two things approximately. First of all, as the chair explained, I'm going to talk a little bit about an artwork invited and featured in the entrance of the Ars Electronica Center right now, 100 Ericas, and this is the work by artist Nori Tanaka, and he wants me to speak for him to explain it, so that's what I'm trying to do. Then, from my own research in cognitive neuroscience, I would like to make three points which, in my mind, are highly relevant to understand so-called human nature. Okay, so 100 Ericas, there are some details here. I heard from the organizers that this will be exhibited beyond this particular event week as a part of regular exhibition. And in fact, maybe some of you have seen it already because it's visible even from the street in front of the center. In fact, the artist is actually sitting there, so I want him to stand up. Please welcome Tanaka-san tatte kureru. My dearest friend, internationally well-known artist, Nori Tanaka is there, so please welcome. And please do not forget, as I listed at the bottom, there's a special event tonight as an artist guided tour. Nori himself will talk about his piece. And I might be there actually to interpret. So this could be the last chance to ask him about his stuff. So please come over. And it looks like this. It is actually 100 photo portraits of a very well-known Japanese actress, singer, pop icon, Erika Sawajiri. And this was not digitally created. She took the pain to have different hairstyle, different cosmetics, different clothes, 200 times actually, and they selected 100. According to Nori, he did this systematically by coming up with the matrix of race times gender times age times culture times era, etc. And he's trying to spread over all different domains by 100 portraits. This is how it looks like in the original exhibition. And today, I just would like to make several points. In fact, he talked to me and asked me to help him in two different ways. One is to have a detailed discussion with him so that he sharpen up his motivation and what he does exactly with this. And secondly, he wanted me to write a text about it, about this 100 portraits. And I did that. And in fact, it is interesting because in his conceptualization, we are trying to go, in fact, against the classical framework of object critique or object critique of art. In other words, in his mind, my text about the portraits are a part of the artwork. And we are trying to have the portraits on one hand, my text on the other hand, And we are trying to have two mirrors, basically, in people's mind, the viewer's mind, so that it's echoing, enhancing, stretching out in their semantic network to trigger imagination. Okay? So my text, it's very unfortunate that it's not translated into German language here for lots of pragmatic reasons, but it was partly like scientific analytic article, partly like an essay, partly like just my monologue in first person, and partly like poem. And by reading those in front of this 100 portraits, people are really excited about what's going on about, you know, these photos. And this is what I like to call neural hyperrealism, because the most exciting art experience activates your brain most. The other thing he said is that he wants to go across the bridge between pure arts and commercialism. And in fact, this 100 Ericas were used for Sony Ericsson TV commercials. So they have still versions and they have movie versions, and both are used for the commercial. So one time in early period of discussion, he raised me this question: why does celebrity exist at all? And I said, what? What do you mean by that? But interesting, right? Regardless of the culture, in the modern world, celebrity exists. Famous people exist. Why is that? It's something to do with people's memory, but it's something to do with reward system in the brain. The other thing, of course, is faces. Now, what is face? Face is for emotional expression. Face is for identify people. But face is also for lots of other psychology. Persona was the original Latin word. I believe Immanuel Kant was the first person who used it as personality sense. But you can talk about, let's say, a famous soccer player. He is the face of this team. He's the face of even, you know, national team. You can say, you can make my face. Well, why did you do that? You just put dirt on my face. Where it's nothing to do with face in the physical sense, right? So face has lots of meanings. And we like to extend it not just to face, but hairstyle, body, manner, everything. Basically, we like to stimulate people to be more aware about implicit, multiple, and context-dependent aspects of identity, personality, and emotion. Okay, so that's that for the one of the Ericas. However, that's highly related to the subsequent part of the talk, because I would like to make several things about implicit mental mechanisms. And when I say implicit, there are four things, approximately, maybe five, and I would like to capture some of these. Evolutionary equipped organs and functions, and I'm going to mention color perception example. And then in some cases, implicit process precedes and underlies explicit experience. And I'm going to show some perception example. Also, sometimes mental events are consciously aware, but they were often people are blind to the causality. So those are the things I'm studying in my own project. Let me mention one study that I did, theoretical analysis study, because it turned out to be highly relevant to the first speaker's talk. And this is something to do with evolutionary theory of account for why human has trichromatic color perception. And the traditional theory was that it's something to do with discriminating maturity of fruit and leaves because our ancestors were eating them. But the problem of this theory is that there are lots of species other than us who are eating fruits and leaves, and they do not have human trichromatic channels. They are usually monochromatic or dual chromatic. So there should be something additional, critical to human themselves. We come up with this theory that perhaps human trichromatic color perception evolved in order to be optimized in discriminating subtle emotional change in the face. The reason is because when you have an emotional expression in the face, the blood flow under the skin changes, and then that is actually a significant part of emotional expression. In fact, according to our scientific analysis, the fundamental color axis of green to red turned out to be highly correlated with the oxygen level attached to the hemoglobin in the optical blood flow. The other cardinal axis of color, which is blue and yellow, turned out to be correlated with the mere amount of blood flow under the skin. So green, red, and blue, yellow are all related to discriminating very subtle aspect of the emotional expression in the skin. Another thing interesting is that bare skin of the face is co-evolved across different species with regards to this color perception evolved. Okay, so that makes a lot sense a lot. With regards to those biological constraints that we have, so why is this interesting? Why is this anything to do with implicit? The reason is the following. When you see red traffic signal, you are not discriminating face emotional expression, but you are still using the same trichromatic channels to discriminate the signal color. Okay, so this is what I mean by we are constrained by or structured by biological constraints. By the way, let me ask a question. Why red is always a stop signal in any countries? It's not by accident, right? Red is alarming. Why? Red is alarming because when we are mad, our skin gets red. Okay. Let me just show what's seemingly irrelevant. This is another art installation that I did with famous internationally known dancer Hiroyo Kitao. She's also an MD, so it's kind of interesting. And we did this in Taipei. And instead of explaining what it is, I just want you to watch this. There's a dancer under this dynamic movie. And I just want you to pay attention to the dancer first, and then fixate in the other part, like top right. And you can easily lose the visibility of the dancer because of camouflage for one thing, but another reason, which is motion-induced blindness. Now, towards the end of this movie, there's something really interesting happens. So please pay attention and look at the dancer herself. Just keep watching. Here, something odd happening. Okay, so did you notice anything? In the middle of the movie, or actual installation, she divided into two bodies. And then one was stationary, the other was moving. It's hard to tell which is real. In the other situations, vigorously moving was actually a movie, and stationary and fading away is the real body. How did we create this? We asked Hiroyo-san to practice 24 hours ago, and we shoot the movie informing her that you are gonna dance online, live, on stage, with your own movie. So she was actually in sync dancing with herself 24 hours younger, okay? So this is what I mean by art can go beyond the fundamental biological constraints that we have, and it's usually invisible. What is the constraint here? Well, our body is single, and we cannot easily divide it into two, okay? Now, well, you know, this is trivial because 24 hours is just a movie. That's not true, right? Because 24 hours ago, she danced in order to collaborate with herself 24 years in future. So it's mutual interaction between herself and herself. Okay? Do you get the idea? Now, in this case, the invisibility part is mainly created by camouflage effect, but I did another installation. This was actually in Science Museum in Japan, Shizuoka Museum. Rukuru is actually abbreviation of seeing, hearing, and touching in Japanese. And this is a regular exhibition, which is still shown. And the point here is that the human body can be easily erased from people's eyes by creating this sparse dots, light blob, optical flow, created by actually disco mirror ball. These are the viewers. This is their friend. He is standing very still along the wall, and the optical flow is sweeping over. People are fixating over here, and then after 5 seconds, this entire body disappears. this is the spookiest experience according to the audience, because they still see the shadow, they still hear the friend's voice, but the body is entirely transparent. Now, the moment they move their eyes, or the moment the friend moves their hand, they suddenly come back again. So this is motion in this blindness. What do I mean by implicit process? In short, implicit process stands for unconscious cognitive or neural processes and or physiological somatic process in the body. And there are ample examples I can show from perception. So things like stereopsis. As you may know, two eyes are better than one eye owing to brain's computation of binocular disparities. But how brain does it is utterly unknown. Even an elementary school kid who has no idea about geometry still can see depth appropriately with two eyes owing to this implicit calculation. Now, the right side is Ebbinghaus illusion or simultaneous size contrast. The inner circle at the top and the bottom, if you compare, even though they are physically the same size, of course, the bottom looks larger. And what is really intriguing is that this effect is independent of knowledge. Whether you know the effect, whether you know the account, the effect works approximately the same way. Secondly, it is really difficult to neglect the surround effect. In other words, to isolate these two inner discs and try to see equal size, it's very, very difficult. So perception is bottom-up, stimulus-triggered, and context-dependent. Likewise, in the figure ground segregation, the left side is a famous face-base figure, and two objects, faces and base, are reversing. But a lot of people misunderstood this because they thought, we have knowledge about faces. We have knowledge about bases, and that's why they're competing. No, that's not true, because just as Rubin himself initially demonstrated on the right side of the figure, when these are utterly meaningless black shape and white shape, the reversal still occurs, okay? So there are ambiguity in the stimulus, and the implicit computation in the brain resolves it. Likewise, in the hidden picture like this, initially you see a male trumpet player, and then later on you realize that there's a beautiful looking woman's face here. Now, this really raises an interesting epistemological question as to whether the face exists from the beginning, or it suddenly starts existing when you notice it, okay? So think about it. But what is really interesting is another case here, and this is actually, I want to show this because it's amusing. When we show this to 5 or 6 years kids and ask what they see, they say, like 80% of them say, dolphins. And we say, what else? And then they say, maybe fish. And we say, what else? And some of them said, nothing, okay? Now, if we show the same figure to dirty old guys like myself, then they say, naked men and women having a great time. And we say, what else? And they say, nothing. Okay, so this is really interesting because a reward system in the brain drives your perception. People can see only what they want to see. Okay, reward system is the official terminology in the cognitive neuroscience in these days. Talking about the implicit process of perception, I just want to show this Audi commercial. I heard that this was shown in Europe years ago, so you might have remembered this. Just to show what implicit brings about explicit or consciousness in the perception. Sound up. I show only once, so really pay attention. Okay, so this is basically a movie version of Asia. And this raises interesting questions to you. If it's impossible, in some sense, how could it be visible, not invisible? That's an interesting question. Also, this really shows the local implicit processing brings about integrated conscious perception. And also, this shows the emotional impact. That is something to do with the neural link between cognition system and emotion system. I'm a little bit late in time, so I have to skip this slide, but basically, this is the brain part that we're talking about, so-called limbic system, or subcortical, emotional circuit, subcortical, reward circuit. I would like to take another example of implicit process in decision making, particularly preference, attractiveness, choice, which is a common theme in this session as well. This photo is actually my own son, younger than 1 month, and his grandmother happened to call on this side, the left side from his viewpoint, and his eyes are turning into the grandmom. And this really shows orienting response, and there's this official term in baby-infant psychophysics, preferential looking, meaning that even babies make a decision about preference, and then they tend to look at whatever they like more. Okay, so now we can raise a question as to whether adults are big babies with this regard in relation to orientation and orienting and preference. So I did this experiment years ago. Basically, you have two faces, gender, age, race matched, baseline attractiveness approximately the same, and then we allow the subjects to compare them with free viewing, and then immediately when they realize consciously which face is more attractive to themselves, they have to press the button immediately. Meanwhile, we are measuring eye movement to see if there's any aspect of eye movement which can predict the observer's attractiveness preference before they are consciously aware. We found basically that eyes are attracted and captured to the to-be-chosen face. But this is mainly and only when attractiveness is the task. When they asked for something else, like which skin is darker or which face is rounder, then this tendency is much, much weaker. So there's something like intrinsic link between bodily orienting and conscious cognitive judgment of attractiveness. Okay? More intriguingly, our fMRI data indicates that the same area is activated without knowing to more attractive face as opposed to less attractive face, even when subjects are not doing attractiveness judgment. So the right side over here is the explicit task, meaning subjects are trying to decide which is more attractive. And this area, subcortical reward-related area called nucleus accumbens, is activated more to the more attractive face. Okay? But if you change the subject and the subject says the other face is more attractive, then his or her nucleus accumbens is activated to that particular face. So it's really all dependent upon subjective preference. However, on the left side shows the same area activity to more attractive face when subjects are consciously doing something else, like which face is rounder. Still, more attractive face triggers activity in the brain. And we have some diagram. Brain dynamics really governs an interaction between implicit and explicit brain is really the key here. But just move on to another aspect, which is something to do with memory and preference. There's no doubt that memory influences your choice, right? You like a particular artwork due to your past history, your education, your taste, your racial background, everything. But how exactly memory influences preference decision is unclear. Let me show one mega hit TV commercials in Japan. This is a commercial series of health drink. And let me show the first one. I need a sound again. So this was series number one. I don't have time, so I have to skip, but you get the idea. Okay, so this goes forever. This is the last one in the series. There's a massive familiarity that is the same format in the song and the format of the icon, the format of the graphics. Even the storyline is the same. Somebody is doing some acrobatic things. That's familiar. But the content of acrobatic activity is entirely different. So that's very, very new. Okay? So it seems like there's some combination of novelty and familiarity, even though logically they are inconsistent with each other, is the key to the attractiveness. In our own study, which I don't have the time to show the data, indicate that both contribute to the attractiveness, but it depends on the object category. And novelty often wins in natural scenes, and familiarity absolutely wins in faces. So if you show the same faces 26 times in our experiment, the attractiveness of the old face is getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, almost linearly with repeated experience. Okay, I think I'm running out of time, but just as my second point, perceiving and exploring itself is rewarding in the human and primates. And I just would like to raise two questions. Young people enjoy perception or sensory motor activity itself, you know, TV game, YouTube, everything. But unfortunately, the neuroscience of reward system has not explained it. So where's the reward? And this is the same question as the first speaker. Where's the reward of art? Where's the reward of a movie? Where's the reward of game? And is there anything to do with, you know, reward system knowledge in neuroscience? So we stick multiple electrodes into a brain area right behind the eyes. It's called orbit frontal cortex, known to be related to reward, and in the monkey, a rat monkey. And we did two tasks. One is to watch YouTube movies. We downloaded top 10 movies and show it to the monkey, okay, while recording from the neurons. The other sessions, monkeys working very hard for subtle visual discrimination, very, very boring task to get just several drops of juice. It turned out that some neurons on the left side as shown respond vigorously to watching reward only, not to the juice reward, and that's shown by blue. Okay, I don't have the details of how to look at the neuroscience data, but just believe me, okay? Behind the eyes of the monkey, there's some neurons activated by watching movies only. In the same area, we, however, found another set of neurons activated only by the juice reward. They are thirsty, okay? So that makes sense. The new finding is that there are some neurons activated by both juice reward and watching reward. Okay, so indeed, watching turned out to be rewarding to the brain in this strict sense. These are two monkeys that we have red work only, yellow both, blue leisure only. And this is anatomical figures showing how those different types of neurons are intermingled, mixed together in the particular part of the brain. Okay, so there's a common currency of reward in the brain, which can be used for watching TV, playing TV games, or to get the juice, right? Maybe I should skip this slide, but basically I showed three findings. Gaze bias effect, your eyes know your preference before your mind knows. Memory influences the orienting, but it's in a different ways depending on face and non-face. And then finally, the seeing, watching, perception itself is rewarding. Why is it rewarding? I would argue that it's connected in the loop like this, okay? Because once the decision is made, then the outcome is evaluated, and that updates the reward map in the memory, and then that in turn leads to the orienting or exploring, and then that is the somatic precursor of the preference decision making. Okay, so there's a positive loop, and I argue that seeing, perceiving itself, hearing the same way, is rewarding only when this positive feedback is massively operating. And this is the basis of art, in my opinion. I really have no time, so let me just make the point. Imagination is the basis of creating creativity. But imagination can be formalized by the term parallel world. In other words, what if or what otherwise, imagination is very, very critical to the reality of our world itself and also for creativity. In fact, even to perceive redness of the red, it will be impossible if you don't know what gray looks like, what green looks like, what blue looks like, what red looks, what yellow looks like. You know all those colors, and that's why you get this qualia of red, redness of the red, okay? So everything is all relative and due to the differential network. I really have to skip this, but basically parallel world turned out to be very, very critical, not for decision making, but also for perception. Neglecting after decision making, you neglect sometimes. After decision making, you feel freedom. That's because there's a possibility in your mind of doing otherwise. If there's no imagination of doing otherwise and no simulation, then it's impossible, right? So internal simulator is very important. And recently I realized that I was mainly talking about future. Okay, each moment you make a decision, this is a time course. Each moment you make the decision, then there are parallel worlds generated. This is intuitively obvious, right? But it turned out that past can also be a parallel world. It happens sometimes, you know, your history understanding changes dramatically, and your evaluation of Vatican, for instance, this is politically inappropriate, but depending on your historical interpretation, your world can be entirely different, okay? So another important point is that this prospective and retrospective parallel worlds are interleaved together to actually create our reality, right? Because redness is a part of our reality, which is impossible if you don't know other colors, green or yellow or white or black. So our reality of the reality, real world, is based upon other worlds, the parallel worlds. So such what else possible structure penetrates through our perception, memory, decision-making, and emotion. I'm done. Okay, just one more minute to finish. So I talked about these things. I don't want to review it. I just want to give you more examples. And I would like to say these hidden constraints on our lives are very, very critical. And scientists are trying to get rid by understanding it, making it visible. Engineers are trying to get rid by physically removing the constraints, right? Physically, we cannot fly. That's a biological constraint. Engineers created flying airplane to get us rid. Okay, so that's what I mean. Now, what do artists do? I would say artists try to get rid by imagining, the removal of these constraints. Okay, do not take me wrong though. I'm not saying that if you're asking me what human nature stands for, I'm not saying that there are hidden constraints and that's the human nature. What I'm saying is that human has intrinsic nature to go beyond, try to get freed from those constraints, and that's the human nature. Thank you very much.